But even if you're stretching yourself in the service of a core personal project, you don't want to act out of character too much or for too long. Remember those trips Professor Little made to the restroom in between speeches? Those hideout sessions tell us that, paradoxically, the best way to act out of character is to stay as true to yourself as you possibly can, starting by creating as many restorative niches as possible in your daily life. Restorative niche is Professor Little's term for the place you go when you want to return to your true self. It can be a physical place, like the path beside the Richelieu River, or a temporal one, like the quiet breaks you plan between sales calls. It can mean canceling your social plans on the weekend before a big meeting at work, practicing yoga or meditation, or choosing email over an in-person meeting. Even Victorian ladies, whose job effectively was to be available to friends and family, were expected to withdraw for a rest each afternoon. You choose a restorative niche when you close the door to your private office, if you're lucky enough to have one, in between meetings. You can even create a restorative niche during a meeting by carefully selecting where you sit and when and how you participate. In his memoir, In an Uncertain World, Robert Rubin, the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, describes how he always liked to be away from the center, whether in the Oval Office or the Chief of Staff's office, where my regular seat became the foot of the table. That little bit of physical distance felt more comfortable to me and let me read the room and comment from a perspective ever so slightly removed. I didn't worry about being overlooked. No matter how far away you were sitting or standing, you could always just say, "Mr. President, I think this, that, or the other." We would all be better off if, before accepting a new job, we evaluated the presence or absence of restorative niches as carefully as we consider the family leave policy or health insurance plans. Introverts should ask themselves, will this job allow me to spend time on in-character activities like, for example, reading, strategizing, writing, and researching? Will I have a private workspace or be subject to the constant demands of an open office plan? If the job doesn't give me enough restorative niches, will I have enough free time on evenings and weekends to grant them to myself? Extroverts will want to look for restorative niches too. Does the job involve talking, traveling, and meeting new people? Is the office space stimulating enough? If the job isn't a perfect fit, are the hours flexible enough that I can blow off steam after work? Think through the job description carefully. One highly extroverted woman I interviewed was excited about a position as the community organizer for a parenting website until she realized that she'd be sitting by herself behind a computer every day from 9 to 5. Sometimes people find restorative niches in professions where you'd least expect them. One of my former colleagues is a trial lawyer who spends most of her time in splendid solitude researching and writing legal briefs. Because most of her cases settle, she goes to court rarely enough that she doesn't mind exercising her pseudo-extroversion skills when she has to. An introverted administrative assistant I interviewed parlayed her office experience into a work-from-home internet business that serves as a clearinghouse and coaching service for virtual assistants. And in the next chapter, we'll meet a superstar salesman who broke his company's sales records year after year by insisting on staying true to his introverted self. All three of these people have taken decidedly extroverted fields and reinvented them in their own image so that they're acting in character most of the time, effectively turning their workdays into one giant restorative niche. Finding restorative niches isn't always easy. You might want to read quietly by the fire on Saturday nights, but if your spouse wishes you'd spend those evenings out with her large circle of friends, then what? You might want to retreat to the oasis of your private office in between sales calls, but what if your company just switched over to an open office plan? If you plan to exercise free traits, you'll need the help of friends, family, and colleagues, which is why Professor Little calls with great passion for each of us to enter into a free trait agreement. This is the final piece of free trait theory. A free trait agreement acknowledges that we'll each act out of character some of the time, in exchange for being ourselves the rest of the time. It's a free trade agreement when a wife who wants to go out every Saturday night and a husband who wants to relax by the fire work out a schedule. Half the time we'll go out, and half the time we'll stay home. It's a free trade agreement when you attend your extroverted best friend's wedding shower, engagement celebration, and bachelorette party. But she understands when you skip out on the 3 days' worth of group activities leading up to the wedding itself. It's often possible to negotiate free trade agreements with friends and lovers whom you want to please and who love your true, in-character self. Your work life is a little trickier, since most businesses still don't think in these terms. For now, you may have to proceed indirectly. Career counselor Shoya Zishi told me the story of one of her clients, an introverted financial analyst who worked in an environment where she was either presenting to clients or talking to colleagues who continually cycled in and out of her office. She was so burned out that she planned to quit her job, until Zishi suggested that she negotiate for downtime. Now, this woman worked for a Wall Street bank, not a culture conducive to a frank discussion about the needs of the highly introverted. So she carefully considered how to frame her request. She told her boss that the very nature of her work, strategic analysis, required quiet time in which to concentrate. Once she made her case empirically, it was easier to ask for what she needed psychologically, 2 days a week of working from home. Her boss said yes. But the person with whom you can best strike a free trade agreement after overcoming his or her resistance is yourself. Let's say you're single. You dislike the bar scene, but you crave intimacy, and you want to be in a long-term relationship in which you can share cozy evenings and long conversations with your partner and a small circle of friends. In order to achieve this goal, you make an agreement with yourself that you will push yourself to go to social events, because only in this way can you hope to meet a mate and reduce the number of gatherings you attend over the long term. But while you pursue this goal, you will attend only as many events as you can comfortably stand. You decide in advance what that amount is. Once a week, once a month, once a quarter. And once you've met your quota, you've earned the right to stay home without feeling guilty. Or perhaps you've always dreamed of building your own small company, working from home so you can spend more time with your spouse and children. You know you'll need to do a certain amount of networking, so you make the following free trade agreement with yourself. You will go to one schmoozefest per week. At each event, you will have at least one genuine conversation, since this comes easier to you than working the room, and follow up with that person the next day. After that, you get to go home and not feel bad when you turn down other networking opportunities that come your way. Professor Little knows all too well what happens when you lack a free trade agreement with yourself. Apart from occasional excursions to the Richelieu River or the restroom, he once followed a schedule that combined the most energy-zapping elements of both introversion and extroversion. On the extroverted side, his days consisted of nonstop lectures, meetings with students, monitoring a student discussion group, and writing all those letters of recommendation. On the introverted side, he took those responsibilities very, very seriously. One way of looking at this, he says now, is to say that I was heavily engaged in extrovert-like behaviors. But of course, had I been a real extrovert, I would have done quicker, less nuanced letters of recommendation, would not have invested the time in preparation of lectures, and the social events would not have drained me. He also suffered from a certain amount of what he calls reputational confusion, in which he became known for being over-the-top effervescent, and the reputation fed on itself. This was the persona that others knew, so it was the persona he felt obliged to serve up. Naturally, Professor Little started to burn out, not only mentally, but also physically. Never mind, he loved his students, he loved his field, he loved it all. Until the day that he ended up in the doctor's office with a case of double pneumonia that he'd been too busy to notice. His wife had dragged him there against his will, and a good thing, too. According to the doctors, if she had waited much longer, he would have died. Double pneumonia and an overscheduled life can happen to anyone, of course, but for Little, it was the result of acting out of character for too long and without enough restorative niches. When your conscientiousness impels you to take on more than you can handle, you begin to lose interest, even in tasks that normally engage you. You also risk your physical health. Emotional labor, which is the effort we make to control and change our own emotions, is associated with stress, burnout, and even physical symptoms like an increase in cardiovascular disease. Professor Little believes that prolonged acting out of character may also increase autonomic nervous system activity, which can, in turn, compromise immune functioning. One noteworthy study suggests that people who suppress negative emotions tend to leak those emotions later in unexpected ways. The psychologist Judith Grob asked people to hide their emotions as she showed them disgusting images. She even had them hold pens in their mouths to prevent them from frowning. She found that this group reported feeling less disgusted by the pictures than did those who'd been allowed to react naturally. Later, however, the people who hid their emotions suffered side effects. Their memory was impaired, and the negative emotions they'd suppressed seemed to color their outlook. When Grobe had them fill in the missing letter to the word GR-SS, for example, they were more likely than others to offer gross rather than grass. People who tend to suppress their negative emotions regularly, concludes Grobe, might start to see the world in a more negative light. That's why, these days, Professor Little is in restorative mode, retired from the university, and reveling in his wife's company in their house in the Canadian countryside. Little says that his wife, Sue Phillips, the director of the School of Public Policy and Administration at Carleton University, is so much like him that they don't need a free trade agreement to govern their relationship. But his free trade agreement with himself provides that he do his remaining scholarly and professional deeds with good grace, but not hang around longer than necessary. Then he goes home and snuggles by the fire with Sue. Chapter 10, The Communication Gap, How to Talk to Members of the Opposite Type. The meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed. Carl Jung. If introverts and extroverts are the north and south of temperament, opposite ends of a single spectrum, then how can they possibly get along? Yet the two types are often drawn to each other, in friendship, business, and especially romance. These pairs can enjoy great excitement and mutual admiration, a sense that each completes the other. One tends to listen, the other to talk. One is sensitive to beauty, but also to slings and arrows, while the other barrels cheerfully through his days. One pays the bills, and the other arranges the children's playdates. But it can also cause problems when members of these unions pull in opposite directions. Greg and Emily are an example of an introvert-extrovert couple who love and madden each other in equal measure. Greg, who just turned 30, has a bounding gait, a mop of dark hair continually falling over his eyes, and an easy laugh. Most people would describe him as gregarious. Emily, a mature 27, is as self-contained as Greg is expansive. Graceful and soft-spoken, she keeps her auburn hair tied in a chignon and often gazes at people from under lowered lashes. Greg and Emily complement each other beautifully. Without Greg, Emily might forget to leave the house, except to go to work. But without Emily, Greg would feel, paradoxically for such a social creature, alone. Before they met, most of Greg's girlfriends were extroverts. He says he enjoyed those relationships, but never got to know his girlfriends well because they were always plotting how to be with groups of people. He speaks of Emily with a kind of awe, as if she has access to a deeper state of being. He also describes her as the anchor around which his world revolves. Emily, for her part, treasures Greg's ebullient nature. He makes her feel happy and alive. She has always been attracted to extroverts who, she says, do all the work of making conversation. For them, it's not work at all. The trouble is that for most of the 5 years they've been together, Greg and Emily have been having one version or another of the same fight. Greg, a music promoter with a large circle of friends, wants to host dinner parties every Friday. Casual, animated get-togethers with heaping bowls of pasta and flowing bottles of wine. He's been giving Friday night dinners since he was a senior in college, and they've become a highlight of his week and a treasured piece of his identity. Emily has come to dread these weekly events. A hard-working staff attorney for an art museum and a very private person, the last thing she wants to do when she gets home from work is entertain. Her idea of a perfect start to the weekend is a quiet evening at the movies, just her and Greg. It seems an irreconcilable difference. Greg wants 52 dinner parties a year. Emily wants zero. Greg says that Emily should make more of an effort. He accuses her of being antisocial. "I am social," she says. "I love you. I love my family. I love my close friends. I just don't love dinner parties. People don't really relate at those parties. They just socialize. You're lucky because I devote all my energy to you. You spread yours around to everyone." But Emily soon backs off, partly because she hates fighting, but also because she doubts herself. "Maybe I am antisocial," she thinks. "Maybe there is something wrong with me." Whenever she and Greg argue about this, she's flooded with childhood memories. How school was tougher for her than for her emotionally hardier younger sister. How she seemed to worry more than other people did about social issues, like how to say no when someone asked her to get together after school and she preferred to stay home. Emily had plenty of friends. She's always had a talent for friendship, but she never traveled in packs. Emily has suggested a compromise. What if Greg gives his dinner parties whenever she's out of town visiting her sister? But Greg doesn't want to host dinners by himself. He loves Emily and wants to be with her, and so does everyone else once they get to know her. So why does Emily withdraw? This question, for Greg, is more than mere pique. Being alone for him is a kind of kryptonite. It makes him feel weak. He had looked forward to a married life of shared adventures. He'd imagined being part of a couple at the center of things. And he'd never admitted it to himself. But for him, being married meant never having to be by himself. But now Emily is saying that he should socialize without her. He feels as if she's backing out of a fundamental part of their marriage contract. And he believes that something is indeed wrong with his wife. Is something wrong with me? It's not surprising that Emily asks herself this question, or that Greg aims this charge at her. Probably the most common and damaging misunderstanding about personality type is that introverts are antisocial and extroverts are prosocial. But as we've seen, neither formulation is correct. Introverts and extroverts are differently social. What psychologists call the need for intimacy is present in introverts and extroverts alike. In fact, people who value intimacy highly don't tend to be, as the noted psychologist David Buss puts it, the loud, outgoing, life-of-the-party extrovert. They are more likely to be someone with a select group of close friends who prefers sincere and meaningful conversations over wild parties. They are more likely to be someone like Emily. Conversely, extroverts do not necessarily seek closeness from their socializing. Extroverts seem to need people as a forum to fill needs for social impact, just as a general needs soldiers to fill his or her need to lead, the psychologist William Graziano told me. When extroverts show up at a party, everyone knows they are present. Your degree of extroversion seems to influence how many friends you have, in other words, but not how good a friend you are. In a study of 132 college students at Humboldt University in Berlin, the psychologists Jens Aspendorf and Susan Wilpers set out to understand the effect of different personality traits on students' relationships with their peers and families. They focused on the so-called Big Five traits: introversion, extroversion, agreeableness, openness to experience, conscientiousness, and emotional stability. Many personality psychologists believe that human personality can be boiled down to these five characteristics. Aspendorf and Wilpers predicted that the extroverted students would have an easier time striking up new friendships than the introverts, and this was indeed the case. But if the introverts were truly antisocial and extroverts prosocial, then you'd suppose that the students with the most harmonious relationships would also be highest in extroversion. And this was not the case at all. Instead, the students whose relationships were freest of conflict had high scores for agreeableness. Agreeable people are warm, supportive, and loving. Personality psychologists have found that if you sit them down in front of a computer screen of words, they focus longer than others do on words like caring, console, and help, and a shorter time on words like abduct, assault, and harass. Introverts and extroverts are equally likely to be agreeable. There is no correlation between extroversion and agreeableness. This explains why some extroverts love the stimulation of socializing, but don't get along particularly well with those closest to them. It also helps explain why some introverts, like Emily, whose talent for friendship suggests that she's a highly agreeable type herself, lavish attention on their family and close friends, but dislike small talk. So when Greg labels Emily antisocial, he's off base. Emily nurtures her marriage in just the way that you'd expect an agreeable introvert to do, making Greg the center of her social universe. Except when she doesn't. Emily has a demanding job, and sometimes when she gets home at night, she has little energy left. She's always happy to see Greg, but sometimes she'd rather sit next to him reading than go out for dinner or make animated conversation. Simply to be in his company is enough. For Emily, this is perfectly natural. But Greg feels hurt that she makes an effort for her colleagues and not for him. This was a painfully common dynamic in the introvert-extrovert couples I interviewed. The introverts desperately craving downtime and understanding from their partners, the extroverts longing for company and resentful that others seem to benefit from their partners' best selves. It can be hard for extroverts to understand how badly introverts need to recharge at the end of a busy day. We all empathize with a sleep-deprived mate who comes home from work too tired to talk. But it's harder to grasp that social overstimulation can be just as exhausting. It's also hard for introverts to understand just how hurtful their silence can be. I interviewed a woman named Sarah, a bubbly and dynamic high school English teacher married to Bob, an introverted law school dean who spends his days fundraising, then collapses when he gets home. Sarah cried tears of frustration and loneliness as she told me about her marriage. "When he's on the job, he's amazingly engaging," she said. "Everyone tells me that he's so funny and I'm so lucky to be married to him, and I want to throttle them. Every night, as soon as we're done eating, he jumps up and cleans the kitchen. Then he wants to read the paper alone and work on his photography by himself. At around 9, he comes into the bedroom and wants to watch TV and be with me. But he's not really with me even then. He wants me to lay my head on his shoulder while we stare at the TV. It's a grown-up version of parallel play." Sarah is trying to convince Bob to make a career change. "I think we'd have a great life if he had a job where he could sit at the computer all day, but he's consistently fundraising," she says. In couples where the man is introverted and the woman extroverted, as with Sarah and Bob, we often mistake personality conflicts for gender difference, then trot out the conventional wisdom that Mars needs to retreat to his cave while Venus prefers to interact. But whatever the reason for these differences in social needs, whether gender or temperament, what's important is that it's possible to work through them. In The Audacity of Hope, for example, President Obama confides that early in his marriage to Michelle, he was working on his first book and would often spend the evening holed up in my office in the back of our railroad apartment. What I considered normal often left Michelle feeling lonely. He attributes his own style to the demands of writing and to having been raised mostly as an only child, and then says that he and Michelle have learned over the years to meet each other's needs and to see them as legitimate. It can also be hard for introverts and extroverts to understand each other's ways of resolving differences. One of my clients was an immaculately dressed lawyer named Celia. Celia wanted a divorce, but dreaded letting her husband know. She had good reasons for her decision, but anticipated that he would beg her to stay and that she would crumple with guilt. Above all, Celia wanted to deliver her news compassionately. We decided to role-play their discussion, with me acting as her husband. "I want to end this marriage," said Celia. "I mean it this time." "I've been doing everything I can to hold things together," I pleaded. "How can you do this to me?" Celia thought for a minute. "I've spent a lot of time thinking this through, and I believe this is the right decision," she replied in a wooden voice. "What can I do to change your mind?" I asked. "Nothing," said Celia flatly. Feeling for a minute what her husband would feel, I was dumbstruck. She was so rote, so dispassionate. She was about to divorce me. Me, her husband of 11 years. Didn't she care? I asked Celia to try again, this time with emotion in her voice. "I can't," she said. "I can't do it." But she did. "I want to end this marriage," she repeated, her voice choked with sadness. She began to weep uncontrollably. Celia's problem was not lack of feeling. It was how to show her emotions without losing control. Reaching for a tissue, she quickly gathered herself and went back into crisp, dispassionate lawyer mode. These were the two gears to which she had ready access: overwhelming feelings or detached self-possession. I tell you Celia's story because in many ways she's a lot like Emily and many introverts I've interviewed. Emily is talking to Greg about dinner parties, not divorce, but her communication style echoes Celia's. When she and Greg disagree, her voice gets quiet and flat, her manner slightly distant. What she's trying to do is minimize aggression. Emily is uncomfortable with anger, but she appears to be receding emotionally. Meanwhile, Greg does just the opposite, raising his voice and sounding belligerent as he gets ever more engaged in working out their problem. The more Emily seems to withdraw, the more alone, then hurt, then enraged Greg becomes. The angrier he gets, the more hurt and distaste Emily feels, and the deeper she retreats. Pretty soon they're locked in a destructive cycle from which they can't escape, partly because both spouses believe they're arguing in an appropriate manner. This dynamic shouldn't surprise anyone familiar with the relationship between personality and conflict resolution style. Just as men and women often have different ways of resolving conflict, so do introverts and extroverts. Studies suggest that the former tend to be conflict avoiders, while the latter are confrontive copers, at ease with an upfront, even argumentative style of disagreement. These are diametrically opposite approaches, so they're bound to create friction. If Emily didn't mind conflict so much, she might not react so strongly to Greg's head-on approach. If Greg were milder-mannered, he might appreciate Emily's attempt to keep a lid on things. When people have compatible styles of conflict, a disagreement can be an occasion for each partner to affirm the other's point of view. But Greg and Emily seem to understand each other a little less each time they argue in a way that the other disapproves of. Do they also like each other a little less, at least for the duration of the fight? An illuminating study by the psychologist William Graziano suggests that the answer to this question might be yes. Graziano divided a group of 61 male students into teams to play a simulated football game. Half the participants were assigned to a cooperative game in which they were told, "Football is useful to us because to be successful in football, team members have to work well together." The other half were assigned to a game emphasizing competition between teams. Each student was then shown slides and fabricated biographical information about his teammates and his competitors on the other team, and asked to rate how he felt about the other players. The differences between introverts and extroverts were remarkable. The introverts assigned to the cooperative game rated all players, not just their competitors, but also their teammates, more positively than the introverts who played the competitive game. The extroverts did just the opposite. They rated all players more positively when they played the competitive version of the game. These findings suggest something very important. Introverts like people they meet in friendly contexts. Extroverts prefer those they compete with. A very different study, in which robots interacted with stroke patients during physical rehabilitation exercises, yielded strikingly similar results. Introverted patients responded better and interacted longer with robots that were designed to speak in a soothing, gentle manner. "I know it is hard, but remember that it's for your own good," and "very nice, keep up the good work." Extroverts, on the other hand, worked harder for robots that used more bracing, aggressive language. "You can do more than that, I know it," and "concentrate on your exercise." These findings suggest that Greg and Emily face an interesting challenge. If Greg likes people more when they're behaving forcefully or competitively, and if Emily feels the same way about nurturing, cooperative people, then how can they reach a compromise about their dinner party impasse and get there in a loving way? An intriguing answer comes from a University of Michigan business school study, not of married couples with opposite personality styles, but of negotiators from different cultures, in this case Asians and Israelis. 76 MBA students from Hong Kong and Israel were asked to imagine they were getting married in a few months and had to finalize arrangements with a catering company for the wedding reception. This meeting took place by video. Some of the students were shown a video in which the business manager was friendly and smiley. The others saw a video featuring an irritable and antagonistic manager. But the caterer's message was the same in both cases. Another couple was interested in the same wedding date. The price had gone up. Take it or leave it. The students from Hong Kong reacted very differently from the Israeli students. The Asians were far more likely to accept a proposal from the friendly business manager than from the hostile one. Only 14% were willing to work with the difficult manager, while 71% accepted the deal from the smiling caterer. But the Israelis were just as likely to accept the deal from either manager. In other words, for the Asian negotiators, style counted as well as substance, while the Israelis were more focused on the information being conveyed. They were unmoved by a display of either sympathetic or hostile emotions. The explanation for this stark difference has to do with how the two cultures define respect. As we saw in Chapter 8, many Asian people show esteem by minimizing conflict. But Israelis, say the researchers, are not likely to view disagreement as a sign of disrespect, but as a signal that the opposing party is concerned and is passionately engaged in the task. We might say the same of Greg and Emily. When Emily lowers her voice and flattens her affect during fights with Greg, she thinks she's being respectful by taking the trouble not to let her negative emotions show. But Greg thinks she's checking out, or, worse, that she doesn't give a damn. Similarly, when Greg lets his anger fly, he assumes that Emily feels, as he does, that this is a healthy and honest expression of their deeply committed relationship. But to Emily, it's as if Greg has suddenly turned on her. In her book, Anger, The Misunderstood Emotion, Carol Tavris recounts a story about a Bengali cobra that liked to bite passing villagers. One day, a swami, a man who has achieved self-mastery, convinces the snake that biting is wrong. The cobra vows to stop immediately, and does. Before long, the village boys grow unafraid of the snake and start to abuse him. Battered and bloodied, the snake complains to the swami that this is what came of keeping his promise. "I told you not to bite," said the swami, "but I did not tell you not to hiss." Many people, like the swami's cobra, confuse the hiss with the bite, writes Tavris. Many people, like Greg and Emily, both have much to learn from the swami's story. Greg to stop biting. Emily, that it's okay for him, and for her, to hiss. Greg can start by changing his assumptions about anger. He believes, as most of us do, that venting anger lets off steam. The catharsis hypothesis, that aggression builds up inside us until it's healthily released, dates back to the Greeks, was revived by Freud, and gained steam during the let-it-all-hang-out 1960s of punching bags and primal screams. But the catharsis hypothesis is a myth, a plausible one, an elegant one, but a myth nonetheless. Scores of studies have shown that venting doesn't soothe anger. It fuels it. We're best off when we don't allow ourselves to go to our angry place. Amazingly, neuroscientists have even found that people who use Botox, which prevents them from making angry faces, seem to be less anger-prone than those who don't, because the very act of frowning triggers the amygdala to process negative emotions, and anger is not just damaging in the moment. For days afterward, venters have repair work to do with their partners. Despite the popular fantasy of fabulous sex after fighting, many couples say that it takes time to feel loving again. What can Greg do to calm down when he feels his fury mounting? He can take a deep breath. He can take a 10-minute break. And he can ask himself whether the thing that's making him so angry is really that important. If not, he might let it go. But if it is, then he'll want to phrase his needs not as personal attacks, but as neutral discussion items. "You're so antisocial" can become, "Can we figure out a way to organize our weekends that works for us both?" This advice would hold even if Emily weren't a sensitive introvert. No one likes to feel dominated or disrespected. But it so happens that Greg's married to a woman who is especially put off by anger. So he needs to respond to the conflict-avoidant wife he has, not the confrontational one that he wishes, at least in the heat of the moment, he were married to. Now let's look at Emily's side of the equation. What could she be doing differently? She's right to protest when Greg bites, when he attacks unfairly. But what about when he hisses? Emily might address her own counterproductive reactions to anger, among them her tendency to slip into a cycle of guilt and defensiveness. We know from Chapter 6 that many introverts are prone from earliest childhood to strong guilt feelings. We also know that we all tend to project our own reactions onto others. Because conflict-avoidant Emily would never bite or even hiss unless Greg had done something truly horrible, on some level she processes his bite to mean that she's terribly guilty of something, anything, who knows what. Emily's guilt feels so intolerable that she tends to deny the validity of all of Greg's claims, the legitimate ones along with those exaggerated by anger. This, of course, leads to a vicious cycle in which she shuts down her natural empathy and Greg feels unheard. So Emily needs to accept that it's okay to be in the wrong. At first she may have trouble puzzling out when she is and when she isn't. The fact that Greg expresses his grievances with such passion makes it hard to sort this out. But Emily must try not to get dragged into this morass. When Greg makes legitimate points, she should acknowledge them, not only to be a good partner to her husband, but also to teach herself that it's okay to have transgressed. This will make it easier for her not to feel hurt and to fight back when Greg's claims are unjustified. Fight back? But Emily hates fighting. That's okay. She needs to become more comfortable with the sound of her own hiss. Introverts may be hesitant to cause disharmony, but, like the passive snake, they should be equally worried about encouraging vitriol from their partners. And fighting back may not invite retaliation, as Emily fears. Instead, it may encourage Greg to back off. She need not put on a huge display. Often, a firm, "That's not okay with me," will do. Every once in a while, Emily might also want to step outside her usual comfort zone and let her own anger fly. Remember, for Greg, heat means connection. In the same way that the extroverted players in the football game study felt warmly toward their fellow competitors, so Greg may feel closer to Emily if she can take on just a little of the coloration of a pumped-up player, ready to take the field. Emily can also overcome her own distaste for Greg's behavior by reminding herself that he's not really as aggressive as he seems. John, an introvert I interviewed who has a great relationship with his fiery wife, describes how he learned to do this after 25 years of marriage. "When Jennifer's after me about something, she's really after me. If I went to bed without tidying the kitchen, the next morning she'll shout at me, 'This kitchen is filthy.' I come in and look around the kitchen. There are 3 or 4 cups out. It's not filthy. But the drama with which she imbues such moments is natural to her. That's her way of saying, 'Gee, when you get a chance, I'd appreciate it if you could just tidy up the kitchen a little more.' If she did say it that way to me, I would say, 'I'd be happy to, and I'm sorry that I didn't do it sooner.' But because she comes at me with that 200-mile-per-hour freight train energy, I want to bridle and say, 'Too bad.' The reason I don't is because we've been married for 25 years, and I've come to understand that Jennifer didn't put me in a life-threatening situation when she spoke that way." So what's John's secret for relating to his forceful wife? He lets her know that her words were unacceptable, but he also tries to listen to their meaning. "I try to tap into my empathy," he says. "I take her tone out of the equation. I take out the assault on my senses, and I try to get to what she's trying to say." And what Jennifer is trying to say, underneath her freight train words, is often quite simple. Respect me. Pay attention to me. Love me. Greg and Emily now have valuable insights about how to talk through their differences. But there's one more question they need to answer. Why exactly do they experience those Friday night dinner parties so differently? We know that Emily's nervous system probably goes into overdrive when she enters a room full of people. And we know that Greg feels the opposite, propelled toward people, conversations, events, anything that gives him that dopamine-fueled, go-for-it sensation that extroverts crave. But let's dig a little deeper into the anatomy of cocktail hour chatter. The key to bridging Greg and Emily's differences lies in the details. Some years ago, 32 pairs of introverts and extroverts, all of them strangers to each other, chatted on the phone for a few minutes as part of an experiment conducted by a neuroscientist named Dr. Matthew Lieberman, then a graduate student at Harvard. When they hung up, they were asked to fill out detailed questionnaires, rating how they'd felt and behaved during the conversation. How much did you like your conversational partner? How friendly were you? How much would you like to interact with this person again? They were also asked to put themselves in the shoes of their conversational partners. How much did your partner like you? How sensitive was she to you? How encouraging? Lieberman and his team compared the answers and also listened in on the conversations and made their own judgments about how the parties felt about each other. They found that the extroverts were a lot more accurate than the introverts in assessing whether their partner liked talking to them. These findings suggest that extroverts are better at decoding social cues than introverts. At first, this seems unsurprising, writes Lieberman. It echoes the popular assumption that extroverts are better at reading social situations. The only problem, as Lieberman showed through a further twist to his experiment, is that this assumption is not quite right. Lieberman and his team asked a select group of participants to listen to a tape of the conversations they'd just had before filling out the questionnaire. In this group, he found there was no difference between introverts and extroverts in their ability to read social cues. Why? The answer is that the subjects who listened to the tape recording were able to decode social cues without having to do anything else at the same time. And introverts are pretty fine decoders, according to several studies predating the Lieberman experiments. One of these studies actually found that introverts were better decoders than extroverts. But these studies measured how well introverts observe social dynamics, not how well they participate in them. Participation places a very different set of demands on the brain than observing does. It requires a kind of mental multitasking, the ability to process a lot of short-term information at once without becoming distracted or overly stressed. This is just the sort of brain functioning that extroverts tend to be well suited for. In other words, extroverts are sociable because their brains are good at handling competing demands on their attention, which is just what dinner party conversation involves. In contrast, introverts often feel repelled by social events that force them to attend to many people at once. Consider that the simplest social interaction between two people requires performing an astonishing array of tasks: interpreting what the other person is saying, reading body language and facial expressions, smoothly taking turns talking and listening, responding to what the other person said, assessing whether you're being understood, determining whether you're well received, and if not, figuring out how to improve or remove yourself from the situation. Think of what it takes to juggle all this at once, and that's just a one-on-one conversation. Now imagine the multitasking required in a group setting, like a dinner party. So when introverts assume the observer role, as when they write novels, or contemplate unified field theory, or fall quiet at dinner parties, they're not demonstrating a failure of will or a lack of energy. They're simply doing what they're constitutionally suited for. The Lieberman experiment helps us understand what trips up introverts socially. It doesn't show us how they can shine. Consider the case of an unassuming-looking fellow named John Berghoff. John is a stereotypical introvert, right down to his physical appearance: lean, wiry body, sharply etched nose and cheekbones, thoughtful expression on his bespectacled face. He's not much of a talker, but what he says is carefully considered, especially when he's in a group. "If I'm in a room with 10 people, and I have a choice between talking and not talking," he says, "I'm the one not talking. When people ask, 'Why aren't you saying anything?' I'm the guy they're saying it to." John is also a standout salesman and has been ever since he was a teenager. In the summer of 1999, when he was still a junior in high school, he started working as an entry-level distributor selling Cutco kitchen products. The job had him going into customers' homes selling knives. It was one of the most intimate sales situations imaginable, not in a boardroom or a car dealership, but inside a potential client's kitchen, selling them a product they'd use daily to help put food on the table. Within John's first 8 weeks on the job, he sold $50,000 worth of knives. He went on to be the company's top representative from over 40,000 new recruits that year. By the year 2000, when he was still a high school senior, John had generated more than $135,000 in commissions and had broken more than 25 national and regional sales records. Meanwhile, back in high school, he was still a socially awkward guy who hid inside the library at lunchtime. But by 2002, he'd recruited, hired, and trained 90 other sales reps and increased territory sales 500% over the previous year. Since then, John has launched Global Empowerment Coaching, his own personal coaching and sales training business. To date, he's given hundreds of speeches, training seminars, and private consultations to more than 30,000 salespeople and managers. What's the secret of John's success? One important clue comes from an experiment by the developmental psychologist Avril Thorne, now a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thorne gathered 52 young women, 26 introverts and 26 extroverts, and assigned them to two different conversational pairings. Each person had one 10-minute conversation with a partner of her own type, and a second conversation of equal length with her dispositional opposite. Thorne's team taped the conversations and asked the participants to listen to a playback tape. This process revealed some surprising findings. The introverts and extroverts participated about equally, giving the lie to the idea that introverts always talk less. But the introvert pairs tended to focus on one or two serious subjects of conversation, while the extrovert pairs chose lighter-hearted and wider-ranging topics. Often the introverts discussed problems or conflicts in their lives, school, work, friendships, and so on. Perhaps because of this fondness for problem talk, they tended to adopt the role of advisor, taking turns counseling each other on the problem at hand. The extroverts, by contrast, were more likely to offer casual information about themselves that established commonality with the other person. You have a new dog? That's great. A friend of mine has an amazing tank of saltwater fish. But the most interesting part of Thorne's experiment was how much the two types appreciated each other. Introverts talking to extroverts chose cheerier topics, reported making conversation more easily, and described conversing with extroverts as a breath of fresh air. In contrast, the extroverts felt that they could relax more with introvert partners and were freer to confide their problems. They didn't feel pressure to be falsely upbeat. These are useful pieces of social information. Introverts and extroverts sometimes feel mutually put off, but Thorne's research suggests how much each has to offer the other. Extroverts need to know that introverts, who often seem to disdain the superficial, may be only too happy to be tugged along to a more lighthearted place, and introverts, who sometimes feel as if their propensity for problem talk makes them a drag, should know that they make it safe for others to get serious. Thorne's research also helps us to understand John Berghoff's astonishing success at sales. He has turned his affinity for serious conversation and for adopting an advisory role rather than a persuasive one into a kind of therapy for his prospects. I discovered early on that people don't buy from me because they understand what I'm selling, explains John. They buy because they feel understood. John also benefits from his natural tendency to ask a lot of questions and to listen closely to the answers. I got to the point where I could walk into someone's house, and instead of trying to sell them some knives, I'd ask 100 questions in a row. I could manage the entire conversation just by asking the right questions. Today, in his coaching business, John does the same thing. I try to tune into the radio station of the person I'm working with. I pay attention to the energy they exude. It's easy for me to do that because I'm in my head a lot anyways. But doesn't salesmanship require the ability to get excited, to pump people up? Not according to John. A lot of people believe that selling requires being a fast talker or knowing how to use charisma to persuade. Those things do require an extroverted way of communicating. But in sales, there's a truism that we have two ears and one mouth, and we should use them proportionately. I believe that's what makes someone really good at selling or consulting. The number one thing is they've got to really listen well. When I look at the top salespeople in my organization, none of those extroverted qualities are the key to their success. And now back to Greg and Emily's impasse. We've just acquired two crucial pieces of information. First, Emily's distaste for conversational multitasking is real and explicable. And second, when introverts are able to experience conversations in their own way, they make deep and enjoyable connections with others. It was only once they accepted these two realities that Greg and Emily found a way to break their stalemate. Instead of focusing on the number of dinner parties they'd give, they started talking about the format of the parties. Instead of seating everyone around a big table, which would require the kind of all-hands conversational multitasking Emily dislikes so much, why not serve dinner buffet-style, with people eating in small casual conversational groupings on the sofas and floor pillows? This would allow Greg to gravitate to his usual spot at the center of the room, and Emily to hers on the outskirts, where she could have the kind of intimate, one-on-one conversations she enjoys. This issue solved, the couple was now free to address the thornier question of how many parties to give. After some back and forth, they agreed on 2 evenings a month, 24 dinners a year, instead of 52. Emily still doesn't look forward to these events, but she sometimes enjoys them in spite of herself. And Greg gets to host the evenings he enjoys so much, to hold on to his identity, and to be with the person he most adores, all at the same time. Chapter 11. On Cobblers and Generals. How to Cultivate Quiet Kids in a World That Can't Hear Them. With anything young and tender, the most important part of the task is the beginning of it. For that is the time at which the character is being formed and the desired impression more readily taken. Plato, The Republic. Mark Twain once told a story about a man who scoured the planet looking for the greatest general who ever lived. When the man was informed that the person he sought had already died and gone to heaven, he made a trip to the pearly gates to look for him. St. Peter pointed at a regular-looking Joe. "That isn't the greatest of all generals," protested the man. "I knew that person when he lived on Earth, and he was only a cobbler." "I know that," said St. Peter. "But if he had been a general, he would have been the greatest of them all." We should all look out for cobblers who might have been great generals, which means focusing on introverted children whose talents are too often stifled, whether at home, at school, or on the playground. Consider this cautionary tale, told to me by Dr. Jerry Miller, a child psychologist and the director of the Center for the Child and the Family at the University of Michigan. Dr. Miller had a patient named Ethan, whose parents brought him for treatment on 4 separate occasions. Each time, the parents voiced the same fears that something was wrong with their child. Each time, Dr. Miller assured them that Ethan was perfectly fine. The reason for their initial concern was simple enough. Ethan was 7, and his 4-year-old brother had beaten him up several times. Ethan didn't fight back. His parents, both of them outgoing, take-charge types with high-powered corporate jobs and a passion for competitive golf and tennis, were okay with their younger son's aggression, but worried that Ethan's passivity was going to be the story of his life. As Ethan grew older, his parents tried in vain to instill fighting spirit in him. They sent him onto the baseball diamond and the soccer field, but Ethan just wanted to go home and read. He wasn't even competitive at school. Though very bright, he was a B student. He could have done better, but preferred to focus on his hobbies, especially building model cars. He had a few close friends, but was never in the thick of classroom social life. Unable to account for his puzzling behavior, Ethan's parents thought he might be depressed. But Ethan's problem, says Dr. Miller, was not depression, but a classic case of poor parent-child fit. Ethan was tall, skinny, and unathletic. He looked like a stereotypical nerd. His parents were sociable, assertive people who were always smiling, always talking to people while dragging Ethan along behind them. Compare their worries about Ethan to Dr. Miller's assessment. He was like the classic Harry Potter kid. He was always reading, says Dr. Miller enthusiastically. He enjoyed any form of imaginative play. He loved to build things. He had so many things he wanted to tell you about. He had more acceptance of his parents than they had of him. He didn't define them as pathological, just as different from himself. That same kid, in a different home, would be a model child. But Ethan's own parents never found a way to see him in that light. The last thing Dr. Miller heard was that his parents finally consulted with another psychologist who agreed to treat their son. And now, Dr. Miller is the one who's worried about Ethan. This is a clear case of an iatrogenic problem, he says. That's when the treatment makes you sick. The classic example is when you use treatment to try to make a gay child into a straight one. I worry for that kid. These parents are very caring and well-meaning people. They feel that without treatment, they're not preparing their son for society, that he needs more fire in him. Maybe there's truth to that last part. I don't know. But whether there is or not, I firmly believe that it's impossible to change that kid. I worry that they're taking a perfectly healthy boy and damaging his sense of self. Of course, it doesn't have to be a bad fit when extroverted parents have an introverted child. With a little mindfulness and understanding, any parent can have a good fit with any kind of child, says Dr. Miller. But parents need to step back from their own preferences and see what the world looks like to their quiet children. Take the case of Joyce and her 7-year-old daughter, Isabel. Isabel is an elfin second grader who likes to wear glittery sandals and colorful rubber bracelets snaking up her skinny arms. She has several best friends with whom she exchanges confidences, and she gets along with most of the kids in her class. She's the type to throw her arms around a classmate who's had a bad day. She even gives her birthday presents away to charity. That's why her mother, Joyce, an attractive, good-natured woman with a wisecracking sense of humor and a bring-it-on demeanor, was so confused by Isabel's problems at school. In first grade, Isabel often came home consumed with worry over the class bully, who hurled mean comments at anyone sensitive enough to feel bruised by them. Even though the bully usually picked on other kids, Isabel spent hours dissecting the meaning of the bully's words, what her true intentions had been, even what the bully might be suffering at home that could possibly motivate her to behave so dreadfully at school. By second grade, Isabel started asking her mother not to arrange playdates without checking with her first. Usually, she preferred to stay home. When Joyce picked up Isabel from school, she often found the other girls gathered into groups and Isabel off on the playground, shooting baskets by herself. She just wasn't in the mix. I had to stop doing pickups for a while, recalls Joyce. It was just too upsetting for me to watch. Joyce couldn't understand why her sweet, loving daughter wanted to spend so much time alone. She worried that something was wrong with Isabel. Despite what she'd always thought about her daughter's empathetic nature, might Isabel lack the ability to relate with others? It was only when I suggested that Joyce's daughter might be an introvert, and explained what that was, that Joyce started thinking differently about Isabel's experiences at school. And from Isabel's perspective, things didn't sound alarming at all. I need a break after school, she told me later. School is hard because a lot of people are in the room, so you get tired. I freak out if my mom plans a play date without telling me because I don't want to hurt my friend's feelings, but I'd rather stay home. At a friend's house, you have to do the things other people want to do. I like hanging out with my mom after school because I can learn from her. She's been alive longer than me. We have thoughtful conversations. I like having thoughtful conversations because they make people happy. Some who read this book before publication commented that the quote from Isabel couldn't possibly be accurate. No second grader talks that way. But this is what she said. Isabel is telling us, in all her second grade wisdom, that introverts relate to other people. Of course they do. They just do it in their own way. Now that Joyce understands Isabel's needs, mother and daughter brainstorm happily, figuring out strategies to help Isabel navigate her school day. Before, I would have had Isabel going out and seeing people all the time, packing her time after school full of activities, says Joyce. Now I understand that it's very stressful for her to be in school, so we figure out together how much socializing makes sense and when it should happen. Joyce doesn't mind when Isabel wants to hang out alone in her room after school, or leave a birthday party a little earlier than the other kids. She also understands that since Isabel doesn't see any of this as a problem, there's no reason that she should. Joyce has also gained insight into how to help her daughter manage playground politics. Once, Isabel was worried about how to divide her time among three friends who didn't get along with each other. "My initial instinct," says Joyce, "would be to say, don't worry about it. Just play with them all." But now I understand that Isabel's a different kind of person. She has trouble strategizing about how to handle all these people simultaneously on the playground. So we talk about who she's going to play with and when, and we rehearse things she can tell her friends to smooth the situation over. Another time, when Isabel was a little older, she felt upset because her friends sat at two different tables in the lunchroom. One table was populated with her quieter friends, the other with the class extroverts. Isabel described the second group as loud, talking all the time, sitting on top of each other. Ugh! But she was sad because her best friend Amanda loved to sit at the crazy table, even though she was also friends with the girls at the more relaxed and chill table. Isabel felt torn. Where should she sit? Joyce's first thought was that the crazy table sounded like more fun. But she asked Isabel what she preferred. Isabel thought for a minute and said, "Maybe every now and then I'll sit with Amanda. But I do like being quieter and taking a break at lunch from everything." "Why would you want to do that?" thought Joyce. But she caught herself before she said it out loud. "Sounds good to me," she told Isabel. "And Amanda still loves you. She just really likes that other table. But it doesn't mean she doesn't like you. And you should get yourself the peaceful time you need." "Understanding introversion," says Joyce, "has changed the way she parents, and she can't believe it took her so long. When I see Isabel being her wonderful self, I value it, even if the world may tell her she should want to be at that other table. In fact, looking at that table through her eyes, it helps me reflect on how I might be perceived by others, and how I need to be aware and manage my extroverted default so as not to miss the company of others like my sweet daughter." Joyce has also come to appreciate Isabel's sensitive ways. "Isabel is an old soul," she says. "You forget that she's only a child. When I talk to her, I'm not tempted to use that special tone of voice that people reserve for children, and I don't adapt my vocabulary. I talk to her the way I would to any adult. She's very sensitive, very caring. She worries about other people's well-being. She can be easily overwhelmed, but all these things go together, and I love this about my daughter."